Large-scale industry is watching the growing trustification of the banks with mixed feelings. Indeed, we have repeatedly seen the beginnings of certain agreements between the individual big banking concerns which aim at limiting competition. Again, the final word in the development of the banks is monopoly. The close ties that exist between the banks and industry are the very things that bring out most strikingly the new role of the banks. When a bank discounts a bill for an industrial firm, opens a current account for it, etc., these operations, taken separately, do not in the least diminish the independence of the industrial firm, and the bank plays no other part than that of a modest intermediary. But when such operations are multiplied and become continuous, when the bank collects in its own hands enormous amounts of capital, when the running of a current account for the firm in question enables the bank, and this is what happens, to become better informed of the economic position of the client, then the result is that industrial capital becomes more completely dependent on the bank. Parallel to this process, there is being developed a very close personal union between the banks and the biggest industrial and commercial enterprises, the fusing of one with the other through the acquisition of shares, through the appointment of bank directors to the boards of industrial and commercial enterprises, and vice versa. The German economist, Geitels, has compiled very complete data on this form of concentration of capital and of enterprises. Six of the biggest Berlin banks were represented by their directors in 344 industrial companies and by their board members in 407 other companies. Altogether, they supervised a total of 751 companies. In 289 of these companies, they either had two of the representatives on each of the respective supervisory boards or held the posts of presidents. These industrial and commercial companies are engaged in the most varied branches of industry, in insurance, transport, restaurants, theaters, art industry, etc. On the other hand, there were on the supervisory boards of the six banks in 1910, 51 of the biggest manufacturers, among whom were the directors of Krupp, of the powerful Hamburg America line, etc. From 1895 to 1810, each of these six banks participated in the share issues of several hundreds of industrial companies, the number ranging from 281 to 419. The personal union between the banks and industry is completed by the personal union between both and the state. Seats on the supervisory board are freely offered to persons of title, also to ex-civil servants, who are able to do a great deal to facilitate relations with the authorities. Generally, there is a member of parliament or a Berlin city councillor on the supervisory board of a big bank. The building, so to speak, of the great capitalist monopolies is, therefore, going full steam ahead by all natural and supernatural ways. A sort of division of labor among some hundreds of kings of finance, who now reign over modern capitalist society, is being systematically developed. Accompanying this widening of the sphere of activity of certain big industrialists, sharing in the management of banks, etc., and together with the allocation of provincial managers to definite industrial regions, there is a growth of specialization among the directors of the great banks. Generally speaking, this specialization is only conceivable when banking is carried out on a large scale, and particularly when it has widespread connections with industry. This division of labor proceeds along two lines. On the one hand, the relations with industry as a whole are entrusted to one manager, as his special function. On the other, each director assumes the supervision of several isolated enterprises or enterprises with allied interests, or in the same branch of industry, sitting on their boards of directors. Capitalism has reached the state of organized control of individual enterprises. One specializes in German industry, sometimes even in West German industry alone. The West is the most industrialized part of Germany. Others specialize in relations with foreign states and foreign industry, in information about personal data, in stock exchange questions, etc. Besides, each bank director is often assigned a special industry or locality, where he has a say on the board of directors. One works mainly on the board of directors of electric companies, another in the chemical, brewing, or sugar beet industry, a third in several isolated undertakings, and at the same time in non-industrial, even insurance companies. It is certain that, as the extent and diversification of the big bank's operation increase, The division of labor among their directors also spreads with the object and result of lifting them somewhat out of pure banking and making them better experts, better judges of the general problems of industry and the special problems of each branch of industry, thus making them more capable of action within the respective bank's industrial sphere of influence. This system is supplemented by the bank's endeavors to have elected to their own board of directors, or to those of their subsidiary banks, men who are experts in industrial affairs, such as industrialists, former officials, especially those formerly in railway service or mining, etc. We find the same system, with only slight difference, in French banking. For instance, one of the three largest French banks, the Crédit Lyonnais, has organized a financial research service, Service des Etudes Financières, which permanently employs about 50 engineers, statisticians, economists, lawyers, etc., at a cost of 600,000 or 700,000 francs per annum. The service is in turn divided into 8 sections, of which one deals with industrial establishments, another with general statistics, a third with railway and steamship companies, a fourth with securities, a fifth with financial reports, etc. The result is twofold. On the one hand, a fusion, or as N. Bucherin aptly calls it, the merging of bank and industrial capital, and on the other hand, a transformation of the banks into institutions of a truly universal character. On this question, we consider it important to quote the exact terms used by Gidels, who has best studied the subject. An examination of the sum total of industrial relationships reveals the universal character of the financial establishments working on behalf of industry. Unlike other kinds of banks and contrary to the requirements often laid down in literature, according to which banks ought to specialize in one kind of business or in one branch of industry in order to maintain a firm footing, the big banks are striving to make their industrial connections as varied and far-reaching as possible, according to locality and branch of business, and are striving to do away with the inequalities of the local and business distribution resulting from the development of various enterprises. One tendency is to make the ties with industry general. The other tendency is to make these ties durable and close. In the 6 big banks, both these tendencies are realized not in full, but to a considerable extent and to an equal degree. Quite often, industrial and commercial circles complain of the terrorism of the banks. We are not surprised, for the big banks command, as will be seen from the following example. On November 19, 1901, one of the big Berlin D banks, such as the name given to the 4 biggest banks whose names begin with the letter D, wrote to the board of directors of the German Central Northwest Cement Syndicate in the following terms. We learn from the notice you published in the Reichsanzeiger of 18th instant that the next general meeting of your company, fixed for the 30th of this month, may decide on measures which are likely to affect changes in your undertakings which we cannot sanction. We deeply regret that for these reasons, we are obliged henceforth to withdraw the credit which has been hitherto allowed you. If the said next general meeting does not decide upon measures we cannot sanction, and if we receive suitable guarantees on this matter for the future, we shall be quite willing to open negotiations with you on the opening of a new credit. As a matter of fact, this is small capital's old complaint about being oppressed by big capital, but in this case, it was a whole syndicate that fell into the category of small capital. The old struggle between big and small capital is being resumed on a new and higher stage of development. It stands to reason that undertakings, financed by big banks handling billions, can accelerate technical progress in a way that cannot possibly be compared with the past. The banks, for example, set up special technical research societies, and only friendly industrial enterprises benefit from their work. To this category belong the Electric Railway Research Association and the Central Bureau of Scientific and Technical Research. The directors of the big banks themselves cannot fail to see that the new conditions of economic life are being created, but they are powerless in the face of these phenomena. Anyone who has watched, in recent years, the changes of incumbents of dictatorships and seats on the board of directors of the big banks cannot fail to have noticed that power is gradually passing into the hands of men who consider the active intervention of the big banks in the general development of production to be indispensable and of increasing importance. It often happens that, between these new men and the old bank directors, disagreements of a business and personal nature often occur on this subject. The question that is in dispute is whether or not the banks, as credit institutions, will suffer from his intervention in industry, whether they are sacrificing tired principals and an assured profit to engage in the field of activity which has nothing in common with their role as intermediaries in providing credit and which is leading the banks into a field where they are more than ever before exposed to the blind forces of trade fluctuations. This is the opinion of many of the older bank directors, while most of the young men consider active intervention in industry to be a necessity as great as that which gave rise, simultaneously, with big modern industry, to the big banks and modern industrial banking. The two parties to this discussion are agreed only on one point, and that is, that as yet there are neither firm principles nor a concrete aim in the new activities of the big banks. The old form of capitalism has had its day. The new form represents a transition towards something. It is hopeless, of course, to seek for firm principles and a concrete aim for the purpose of reconciling monopoly with free competition. The admission of the practical men has had quite a different ring from the official praises of the charms of organized capitalism sung by its apologists, Schulz-Gavernitz, Liefman, and similar theoreticians. At precisely what period was the new activity of big banks finally established? Gidels gives us a fairly exact answer to this important question. The ties between the industrial enterprises, with their new content, their new forms, and their new organs, namely, the big banks which are organized on both a centralized and decentralized basis, were scarcely a characteristic economic phenomenon before 1890. In one sense, indeed, this initial date may be advanced to the year 1897, when the important mergers took place and when, for the first time, the new form of decentralized organization was introduced to suit the industrial policy of the banks. This starting point could perhaps be placed at an even later date, for it was only the crisis of 1900 that enormously accelerated and intensified the process of concentration of industry in banking, consolidated that process, and more than ever transformed the connection with industry into the monopoly of the big banks, and made this connection, taken individually, much closer and more active. Thus, the beginning of the 20th century marks the turning point at which the old capitalism gave way to the new, at which the domination of capital in general made way for the domination of finance capital. Chapter 3: Finance Capital and Financial Oligarchy. An increasing proportion of industrial capital does not belong to the industrialists who employ it. They obtain the use of it only through the medium of the banks, which, in relation to them, represent the owners of the capital. On the other hand, the bank is forced to put an increasing share of its funds into industry. Thus, to an increasing degree, the banker is being transformed into an industrial capitalist. This bank capital, i.e., capital in money form, which is thus really transformed into industrial capital, I call finance capital. So finance capital is capital controlled by the banks and employed by the industrialists. This definition is incomplete insofar as it is silent on one extremely important fact: the increase of concentration of production and of capital to such an extent that it leads, and has led, to monopoly. But throughout the whole of his work, and particularly in the two chapters which precede the one from which this definition is taken, Hilferding stresses the part played by capitalist monopolies. The concentration of production, the monopoly arising therefrom, the merging or coalescence of banking with industry, this is the history of finance capital and what gives the term finance capital its content. We now have to describe how, under commodity production and private property, the domination of capitalist monopolies inevitably becomes the domain of a financial oligarchy. It should be noted that the representatives of German bourgeois science, and not only of German science, like Reiser, Schulz-Gavernitz, Liefman, and others, are all apologists for imperialism and for finance capital. Instead of revealing the mechanics of the formation of an oligarchy, its methods, its revenues, innocent and sinful, its connections with parliament, etc., they conceal, obscure, and embellish them. They evade these vexed questions by a few vague and pompous phrases, appeals to the sense of responsibility of bank directors, praising the sense of duty of Prussian officials by giving serious study to petty details, to ridiculous bills for the supervision and regulation of monopolies, by playing with theories like, for example, the following scientific definition arrived at by Professor Leifman. Commerce is gainful occupation carried on by collecting goods, storing it, and making it available. The professor's italics. From this, it would follow that primitive man, who knew nothing about exchange, was a trader, and that commerce will exist under socialism. But the monstrous facts concerning the monstrous rule of the financial oligarchy are so striking that in all capitalist countries, in America, France, and Germany, a whole literature has sprung up, written from the bourgeois point of view, but which, nevertheless, gives a fairly accurate picture and criticism. Petty bourgeois, naturally, of this oligarchy. The holding system, to which we have already briefly referred above, should be placed at the cornerstone. The German economist, Heyman, probably the first to call attention to this matter, describes it in this way. The executive director controls the parent company. The latter reigns over the subsidiary companies which similarly control still other subsidiaries. Thus, it is possible with a comparatively small capital to dominate immense spheres of production. As a matter of fact, if holding 50% of the capital is always sufficient to control a company, the executive director needs only 1 million to control 8 millions in the second subsidiaries. And, if this interlocking is extended, it is possible with 1 million to control 16, 32, or more millions. Experience shows that it is sufficient to own 40% of the shares of a company in order to direct its affairs, since a certain number of small shareholders find it impossible, in practice, to attend general meetings, etc. The democratization of the ownership of shares, from which the bourgeois sophists and opportunists would-be social democrats expect, or declare that they expect, the democratization of capital, the strengthening of the role of small-scale production, etc., is in fact one of the ways of increasing the power of the financial oligarchy. For this reason, among others, in the more advanced or in the older and more experienced capitalist countries, the law allows the issue of shares of very small denomination. In Germany, it is illegal to issue shares of less value than 1,000 marks, and the magnates of German finance look with an envious eye at England, where it is legal to issue £1 shares. Siemens, one of the biggest industrialists and financial kings in Germany, told the Reichstag on June 7, 1900, that the £1 share is the basis of British imperialism. This merchant has a much deeper and more Marxian understanding of imperialism than a certain disreputable writer, generally held to be one of the founders of Russian Marxism, who believes that imperialism is a bad habit of a certain nation. But the holding system not only serves to increase the power of the monopolists enormously, it also enables them to resort with impunity to all sorts of shady tricks to cheat the public, for the directors of the parent company are not legally responsible for the subsidiary companies, which are supposed to be independent and through the medium of which they can do anything. Here is an example taken from the German review Die Bank for May 1914. The Spring Steel Corporation of Kassel was regarded some years ago as being one of the most profitable enterprises in Germany. Through bad management, its dividends fell within the space of a few years from 15% to nil. It appears that the board, without consulting the shareholders, had loaned 6 million marks to one of the subsidiary companies, the Hassia Limited, which had a nominal capital of only some hundreds of thousands of marks. This commitment, amounting to nearly treble the capital of the parent company, was never mentioned in its balance sheets. This omission was quite legal and could be kept up for 2 whole years because it did not violate any provisions of company law. The chairman of the supervisory board, who as the responsible head signed the false balance sheets, was and still is the president of the Kassel Chamber of Commerce. The shareholders only heard of the loan to Hassia Limited long afterwards, when it had long been proved to have been a mistake. The word this writer should have put in quotation marks. And when Spring Steel shares had dropped nearly 100 points, because those in the know had got rid of them. This typical example of balance sheet jugglery, quite common in joint stock companies, explains why boards of directors are more willing to undertake risky transactions than individual enterprises. Modern methods of drawing up balance sheets not only make it possible to conceal doubtful undertakings from the average shareholder, but also allow the people most concerned to escape the consequence of unsuccessful speculation by selling their shares in time while the private dealer risks his own skin. The balance sheets of most joint stock companies put us in mind of the palimpsests of the Middle Ages, from which the visible inscription had first to be erased in order to discover beneath another inscription giving the real meaning of the document. Palimpsests are parchment documents on which the original inscription was obliterated and another inscription imposed. The simplest, and therefore most common procedure for making balance sheets indecipherable is to divide a single business into several parts by setting up subsidiary companies or by annexing such. The advantages of this system for various objects, legal and illegal, are so evident that it is quite unusual to find an important company in which it is not actually in use. As an example of an important monopolist company widely employing this system, the author quotes the famous Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft, the AEG, to which we shall refer later on. In 1912, it was calculated that this company held shares in from 175 to 200 other companies, controlling them, of course, and thus having control of a total capital of 1,500 million marks. All rules of control, the publication of balance sheets, the drawing up of balance sheets according to a definite form, the public auditing of accounts, the things about which well-intentioned professors and officials, that is, those imbued with the good intention of defending and embellishing capitalism, discourse to the public, are of no avail. For private property is sacred, and no one can be prohibited from buying, selling, exchanging, or mortgaging shares, etc. The extent to which this holding system has developed in the big Russian banks may be judged by the figures given by E. Agad, who was for 15 years an official of the Russo-Chinese Bank, and who, in May 1914, published a book not altogether correctly entitled Big Banks and the World Market. The author divides the great Russian banks into two main categories: A, those which operate as holding banks, and B, independent banks, the independence of the latter being arbitrarily taken to mean being independent of foreign banks. The author subdivides the first group into three subgroups: 1, German holding banks, 2, British, and 3, French, having in view those houses in whose business the big banks of the three European countries mentioned hold stock and predominate. The author divides the capital of the banks into productively invested capital in industrial and commercial undertakings and speculatively invested capital in stock exchange and financial operations, assuming from his petty bourgeois reformist point of view that it is possible, under capitalism, to separate the first form of investment from the second, and to abolish the second form. Here are the figures he supplies. Bank assets, according to reports for October through November 1913, in millions of rubles. Groups of Russian banks: A1, four banks, Siberian Commercial Bank, Russian Bank, International Bank, and Discount Bank. Capital invested, productive, 413.7. Speculative, 859.1. Total, 1,272.8. 2. Two banks, Industrial and Commercial and Russo-British. Capital invested, productive, 239.3. Speculative, 169.1. Total, 408.4. 3. Five banks: Russian Asiatic, St. Petersburg Private, Azov Don, Union Moscow, Russo-French Commercial. Capital invested, productive, 711.8. Speculative, 661.2. Total, 1,373.0. Total, for 11 banks: capital invested, productive, 1,364.8. Speculative, 1,689.4. Total, 3,054.2. B. Eight banks: Moscow Merchant, Volga Kama, Junker & Co., St. Petersburg Commercial, formerly Wawelberg, Bank of Moscow, formerly Ryabushinsky, Moscow Discount, Moscow Commercial, Private Bank of Moscow. Capital invested, productive, 504.2. Speculative, 391.1. Total, 895.3. Total for 19 banks, capital invested productive, 1,869.0. Speculative, 2,080.5. Total, 3,949.5. According to these figures, of the approximately 4 billion rubles making up the working capital of the big banks, more than three-fourths, more than 3 billion belong to banks which in reality were only subsidiary companies of foreign banks, and chiefly of the Paris banks. The famous trio Union Parisienne, Paris et Pays-Bas, and Societe Generale. And of the Berlin banks, particularly the Deutsche Bank and the Discounto Gesellschaft. Two of the most important Russian banks, the Russian Bank for Foreign Trade and the St. Petersburg International Commercial, between 1906 and 1912, increased their capital from 44 million to 98 million rubles, and their reserve from 15 million to 39 million, employing three-fourths German capital. The first belongs to the Deutsche Bank Group, and the second to the Discounto Gesellschaft. The worthy Agade is indignant at the fact that the majority of the shares are held by German banks, and that, therefore, the Russian shareholders are powerless. Naturally, the company which exports capital skims the cream. For example, the Deutsche Bank, while introducing the shares of the Siberian Commercial Bank on the Berlin market, kept them in its portfolio for a whole year, and then sold them at a rate of 193 for 100, that is, at nearly twice their nominal value, earning a profit of nearly 6 million rubles, which Hilferding calls promoter's profits. Our author puts the total resources of the principal St. Petersburg banks at 8,235 million rubles, and the holdings, or rather, the extent to which foreign banks dominated them, he estimates as follows. French banks, 55%. English, 10%. German, 35%. The author calculates that of the total of 8,235 million rubles of functioning capital, 3,687 million rubles, or over 40%, fall to the share of the syndicates, Prudhoe and Prodomeda, and the syndicates in the oil, metallurgical, and cement industries. Thus, the merging of bank and industrial capital has also made great strides in Russia owing to the formulation of capitalist monopolies. Finance capital, concentrated in a few hands and exercising a virtual monopoly, exacts enormous and ever-increasing profits from the floating of companies, issue of stock, state loans, etc., tightens the grip of the financial oligarchies, and levies tribute upon the whole of society for the benefit of the monopolists. Here is an example, taken from a multitude of others, of the methods employed by American trusts, quoted by Hilferding in 1887. Havemeyer founded the Sugar Trust by amalgamating 15 small firms, whose total capital amounted to nearly $6,500,000. Suitably watered, as the Americans say, the capital of the trust was increased to $50 million. This overcapitalization anticipated the profits of the monopoly in the same way as the United States Steel Corporation anticipated its profits by buying up as many iron fields as possible. In fact, the Sugar Trust managed to impose monopoly prices on the market, which secured it such profits that it could pay 10% dividend on capital watered sevenfold, or about 70% on the capital actually invested at the time of the creation of the trust. In 1909, the capital of the Sugar Trust was increased to $90 million. In 22 years, it had increased its capital more than tenfold. In France, the role of the financial oligarchy. Against the financial oligarchy in France, the title of the well-known book by Lysis, the fifth edition of which was published in 1908, assumed a form that was only slightly different. Four of the most powerful banks enjoy not a relative but an absolute monopoly in the issue of bonds. In reality, this is a trust of the big banks, and their monopoly ensures the monopolist profits from bond issues. A country borrowing from France rarely gets more than 90% of the total of the loan, The remaining 10% goes to the banks of other middlemen. The profit made by the banks out of the Russo-Chinese loans of 400 million francs amounted to 8%. Out of the Russian 1904 loan of 800 million francs, the profit amounted to 10%. And out of the Moroccan 1904 loan of 62,500,000 francs, to 18.75%. Capitalism, which began its development with petty usury capital, ends its development with gigantic usury capital. The French, says Lysis, are the usurers of Europe. All the conditions of economic life are being profoundly modified by this transformation of capitalism. With a stationary population and stagnant industry, commerce, and shipping, the country can grow rich by usury. 50 persons, representing a capital of 8 million francs, can control 2 billion francs deposited in 4 banks. The holding system, with which we are already familiar, leads to the same results. One of the biggest banks, the Société Générale, for instance, issues 64,000 bonds for one of its subsidiary companies, the Egyptian sugar refineries. The bonds are issued at 150%, the bank gaining 50 centimes on the franc. The dividends of the new company are then found to be fictitious. The public lost from 90 to 100 million francs. One of the directors of the Société Générale is a member of the board of directors of the Egyptian sugar refineries. Hence, it is not surprising that the author is driven to the conclusion that the French Republic is a financial monarchy. It is the complete domination of the financial oligarchy. The latter controls the press and the government. The extraordinarily high rate of profit obtained from the issue of bonds, which is one of the principal functions of finance capital, plays a large part in the development and stabilization of the financial oligarchy. There is not, in the whole country, a single business that brings in profits even approximately equal to those obtained from the issue of foreign loans, says the German magazine Die Bank. No banking operation brings in profits comparable with those obtained from the flotation of loans. According to the German Economist, the average annual profits made on the issue of industrial securities were as follows. 1895, 38.6%. 1896, 36.1%. 1897, 66.7%. 1898, 67.7%. 1899, 66.9%. 1900, 55.2%. In the 10 years from 1891 to 1900, more than a billion marks were earned on the issue of industrial securities. While, during periods of the industrial boom, the profits of finance capital are disproportionately large, during periods of depression, small and unsound businesses go out of existence, and the banks take holdings in their shares, which are bought up for next to nothing, or in profitable schemes for their reconstruction and reorganization. In the reconstruction of undertakings which have been running at a loss, the share capital is written down, that is, profits are distributed on the smaller capital and subsequently are calculated on this smaller basis. If the income has fallen to nil, new capital is called in, which, combined with the old and less remunerative capital, will bring in an adequate return. Incidentally, adds Hilferding, these reorganizations and reconstructions have a twofold significance for the banks. First, as profitable transactions, and secondly, as opportunities for securing control of the companies in difficulties. Here is an instance. The Union Mining Company of Dortmund, founded in 1872 with a capital of about 40 million marks, saw the market price of its shares rise to 170 after it had paid a 12% dividend in its first year. Finance capital skimmed the cream and earned a trifle of something like 28 million marks. The principal sponsor of this company was that very big German Disconto Gesellschaft, which so successfully attained a capital of 300 million marks. Later, the dividends of the union dropped to nil. The shareholders had to consent to a writing down of capital, that is, to losing some of it in order not to lose it all. By a series of reconstructions, more than 73 million marks were written off the books of the union in the course of 30 years. At present time, the original shareholders of this company possess only 5% of the nominal value of their shares. but the bank made a profit out of every reconstruction. Speculation in land situated in the suburbs of rapidly growing towns is a particularly profitable operation for finance capital. The monopoly of the banks merges here with the monopoly of ground rent and with the monopoly of the means of communication, since the increase in value of the land and the possibility of selling it profitably in allotments is mainly dependent on good means of communication with the center of the town, and these means of communication are in the hands of large companies connected, by means of the holding system and by the distribution of positions on the directorates, with the interested banks. As a result, we get what the German writer L. Eschwage, a contributor to Die Bank, who has made a special study of real estate business and mortgages, calls the formation of a bog. Frantic speculation in land and the suburbs of large towns, collapse of building enterprises like that of the Berlin firm of Boswau and Nauer, which grabbed 100 million marks with the help of the sound and solid Deutsche Bank, the latter acting, of course, discreetly behind the scenes through the holding system and getting it out by losing only 12 million marks, the ruin of small masters and of workers who get nothing from the fraudulent building firms, underhand agreements with the honest Berlin police and the Berlin administration for the purpose of getting control of the issue of building sites, tenders, building licenses, etc. American ethics, so strongly but hypocritically condemned by European professors and well-meaning bourgeois, have, in the age of finance capital, become the ethics of literally every large city, no matter what country it is in. At the beginning of 1914, there was talk in Berlin of the proposed formation of a traffic trust to combine three Berlin traffic undertakings, i.e., to establish common interests between the Metropolitan Electric Railway, the tramway company, and the omnibus company. "We know," wrote D. Bank, "that this plan has been contemplated since it became known that the majority of the shares in the bus company has been acquired by the other two traffic companies. We may believe those who are pursuing this aim when they say that by uniting the transport services, they will unify traffic and thus secure economies, part of which will in time benefit the public. But the question is complicated by the fact that behind the traffic trust that is being formed are the banks, which, if they desire, can subordinate the means of communication, which they have monopolized, to the interests of the real estate business. To be convinced of the reasonableness of such a conjecture, we need only recall that at the very formation of the elevated railway company, the traffic interests became interlocked with the real estate interests of the bank which financed it, and this interlocking even created the prerequisites for the formation of the traffic enterprise. Its eastern line, in fact, was to run through land which, when it became certain the line was going to be laid down, this bank sold to the real estate firm at an enormous profit for itself and for several partners in the transaction. A monopoly, once it is formed and controls thousands of millions, inevitably penetrates into every sphere of public life, regardless of the form of government and all other details. In the economic literature of Germany, one usually comes across the servile praise of the integrity of the Prussian bureaucracy, and allusions to the French Panama scandal and to political corruption in America. But the fact is that even the bourgeois literature devoted to German banking matters constantly has to go beyond the field of purely banking operations and to speak, for instance, of the attraction of the banks, in reference to the increasing frequency with which public officials take employment with the banks. "How about the integrity of a state official who in his inmost heart is aspiring to a soft job in the Bahnhofstrasse?" The street in Berlin in which the head office of the Deutsche Bank is situated. In 1909, the publisher of Die Bank, Alfred Landsberg, wrote an article entitled "The Economic Significance of Byzantinism," in which he incidentally referred to Wilhelm II's tour of Palestine and to the immediate result of this journey, the construction of the Baghdad Railway, that fatal, great product of German enterprise which is more responsible for the encirclement than all our political blunders put together. By encirclement is meant the policy of Edward VII of isolating Germany by surrounding her with an imperialist anti-German alliance. In 1912, another contributor to this magazine, Eschwege, to whom we have already referred, wrote an article entitled "Plutocracy and Bureaucracy," in which he exposes the case of a German official named Volker, who was a zealous member of the cartel committee and who sometime later obtained a lucrative post in the biggest cartel, i.e., the Steel Syndicate. Similar cases, by no means casual, force this bourgeois author to admit that the economic liberty guaranteed by the German Constitution is at present, in many departments of economic life, only a meaningless phrase, and that under the rule of the plutocrats, the widest political liberty cannot save us from being converted into a nation of unfree people. As for Russia, we will content ourselves by quoting one example. Some years ago, all the newspapers announced that Davidoff, the director of the credit department of the Treasury, had resigned his post to take employment with a certain big bank at a salary which, according to the contract, was to the amount of over 1 million rubles in the course of several years. The function of the credit department is to coordinate the activities of all the credit institutions of the country. It also grants subsidies to banks in St. Petersburg and Moscow, amounting to between 800 and 1,000 million rubles. Generally speaking, under capitalism, the ownership of capital is separate from the application of capital to production. Money capital is separate from industrial or productive capital. The rentier, living entirely on income obtained from money capital, is separated from the entrepreneur and from all those directly concerned in the management of capital. Imperialism, or the rule of finance capital, is that highest stage of capitalism in which this separation reaches vast proportions. The supremacy of finance capital over all other forms of capital means the rule of the rentier and of the financial oligarchy. It means the crystallization of a small number of financially powerful states from among all the rest. The extent to which this process is going on may be judged from the statistics on emissions, i.e., the issue of all kinds of securities. In the Bulletin of the International Statistical Institute, A. Nymark has published very comprehensive and complete comparative figures covering the issue of securities all over the world, which have been repeatedly quoted in economic literature. The following are the totals he gives for 4 decades. Total issues in billions of francs. 1871 to 1880, 76.1. 1881 to 1890, 64.5. 1891 to 1900, 100.4. 1901 to 1910, 197.8. In the 1870s, the total amount of issues for the whole world was high, owing particularly to the loans floated in connection with the Franco-Prussian War and the company promoting boom which set in Germany after the war. In general, the increase is not very rapid for the last 3 decades of the 19th century, and only in the first 10 years of the 20th century is an enormous increase observed of almost 100%. Thus, the beginning of the 20th century marks the turning point, not only in regard to the growth of monopolies, cartels, syndicates, trusts, of which we have already spoken, but also in regard to the development of finance capital. Nymark estimates the total amount of issued securities current in the world in 1910 at about 815 billion francs. Deducting from his amounts, which might have been duplicated, he reduces the total to 575 to 600 billion, which is distributed among the various countries as follows. We will take 600 billion. Financial securities current in 1910 in billions of francs. Great Britain, 142. United States, 132, France, 110, Germany, 95, accounting for 479, Russia, 31, Austria-Hungary, 24, Italy, 14, Holland, 12.5, Japan, 12, Belgium, 7.5, Spain, 7.5, Switzerland, 6.25, Denmark, 3.75, Sweden, Norway, Romania, etc., 2.5, total 600. It will be seen at once from these figures what a privileged position is held by 4 of the richest capitalist countries, each of which controls securities to amounts ranging approximately from 100 to 150 billion francs. 2 of these countries are the oldest capitalist countries and, as we shall see, possess the most colonies. England and France, the other 2, are in the front rank as regards rapidity of development and the degree of extension of capitalist monopolies in the industry, the United States and Germany. Together, these 4 countries own 479 billion francs, that is, nearly 80% of the world's finance capital, Thus, in one way or another, the whole world is more or less the debtor to and vassal of these four international banker countries, the four pillars of world finance capital. It is particularly important to examine the part which capital exports play in creating the international network of dependence and ties of finance capital. Chapter 4. The Export of Capital. Under the old type of capitalism, when free competition prevailed, the export of goods was the most typical feature. Under modern capitalism, when monopolies prevail, the export of capital has become the typical feature. Capitalism is commodity production at the highest stage of development, when labor power itself becomes a commodity. The growth of internal exchange, and particularly of international exchange, is a special feature of capitalism. The uneven and spasmodic character of the development of individual enterprises, of individual branches of industry, and individual countries is inevitable under the capitalist system. England became a capitalist country before any other, and in the middle of the 19th century, having adopted free trade, claimed to be the workshop of the world, the great purveyor of manufactured goods to all other countries, which, in exchange, were to keep her supplied with raw materials. In the last quarter of the 19th century, this monopoly was already undermined. Other countries, protecting themselves by tariff walls, had developed into independent capitalist countries. On the threshold of the 20th century, we see a new type of monopoly coming into existence. First, there are monopolist-capitalist combines in all advanced capitalist countries. Secondly, a few rich countries, in which the accumulation of capital reaches gigantic proportions, occupy a monopolist position. An enormous superfluity of capital has accumulated in the advanced countries. It goes without saying that if capitalism could develop agriculture, which today lags far behind industry everywhere, if it could raise the standard of living of the masses, who are everywhere still poverty-stricken and underfed, in spite of the amazing advance in technical knowledge, there could be no talk of a superfluity of capital. This argument, the petty bourgeois critics of capitalism advance on every occasion. But if capitalism did these things, it would not be capitalism, for uneven development and wretched conditions of the masses are the fundamental and inevitable conditions and premises of this mode of production. As long as capitalism remains what it is, surplus capital will never be utilized for the purpose of raising the standard of living of the masses for a given country, for this would mean a decline in profits for the capitalists. It will be used for the purpose of increasing those profits by exporting capital abroad to the backward countries. In these backward countries, profits usually are high, for capital is scarce, the price of land is relatively low, wages are low, raw materials are cheap. The possibility of exporting capital is created by the entry of numerous backward countries into international capitalist intercourse. Main railways have either been built or are being built there. The elementary conditions for industrial development have been created, etc. The necessity of exporting capital arises from the fact that in a few countries, capitalism has become overripe and, owing to the backward state of agriculture and the impoverished state of the masses, capital cannot find profitable investment. Here are approximate figures showing the amount of capital invested abroad by the three principal countries. Capital invested abroad in billions of francs. Year 1962, Great Britain 3.6, France no data, Germany no data. Year 1872, Great Britain 15.0, France 10, 1869, Germany no data. 1882, Great Britain 22.0, France 15, 1880, Germany no data. 1893, Great Britain 42, France 20, 1890, Germany no data. 1902, Great Britain 62.0, France 27-37, Germany 12.5. 1914, Great Britain 75-100, France 60, Germany 44.0. This table shows that the export of capital reached formidable dimensions only in the beginning of the 20th century. Before the war, the capital invested abroad by the three principal countries amounted to between 175 and 200 billion francs. At the modest rate of 5%, This sum brought in from 8 to 10 billions a year. This provided a solid basis for imperialist oppression and the exploitation of most of the countries and nations of the world. A solid basis for the capitalist parasitism of a handful of wealthy states. How is this capital invested abroad distributed among the various countries? Where does it go? Only an approximate answer can be given to this question, but sufficient to throw light on certain general relations and ties of modern imperialism. Approximate distribution of foreign capital, about 1910, in billions of marks. Continent, Europe, Great Britain 4, France 23, Germany 18, total 45. Continent, America, Great Britain 37, France 4, Germany 10, total 51. Continent, Asia, Africa, Australia, Great Britain 29, France 8, Germany 7, total 44, for a total of Great Britain 70, France 35, Germany 35, total 140. The political spheres of investment of British capital are the British colonies, which are very large also in America, for example Canada, as well as in Asia, etc. In this case, enormous exports of capital are bound up with the possession of enormous colonies, of the importance of which for imperialism we shall speak later. In regard to France, the situation is quite different. French capital exports are invested mainly in Europe, particularly in Russia, at least 10 billion francs. This is mainly loan capital, in the form of government loans and not investments in industrial undertakings. Unlike British colonial imperialism, French imperialism might be termed usury imperialism. In regard to Germany, we have a third type. The German colonies are inconsiderable, and German capital invested abroad is divided fairly evenly between Europe and America. The export of capital greatly affects and accelerates the development of capitalism in those countries to which it is exported. Well, therefore, the export of capital may tend to a certain extent to arrest development in the countries exporting capital. It can only do so by expanding and deepening the further development of capitalism throughout the world. The countries which export capital are nearly always able to obtain advantages, the character of which throws light on the peculiarities of the epoch of finance capital and monopoly. The following passage, for instance, occurred in the Berlin Review, D. Bank, for October 1913. A comedy worthy of the pen of Aristophanes is being played just now on the international money market. Numerous foreign countries, from Spain to the Balkan states, from Russia to the Argentine, Brazil, and China, are openly or secretly approaching the big money markets demanding loans, some of which are very urgent. The money market is not at the moment very bright, and the political outlook is not yet promising. But not a single money market dares to refuse a loan, for fear that its neighbor might grant it, and so secure some small reciprocal service. In these international transactions, the creditor nearly always manages to get some special advantages. An advantage of a commercial political nature, a coaling station, a contract to construct a harbor, a fat concession, or an order for guns. Finance capital has created the epoch of monopolies, and monopolies introduce everywhere monopolist methods. The utilization of connections for profitable transactions takes the place of competition on the open market. The most usual thing is to stipulate that part of the loan that is granted shall be spent on purchases in the country of issue, particularly on orders for war materials or for ships, etc. In the course of the last two decades, 1810 to 1890, France often resorted to this method. The export of capital abroad thus becomes a means for encouraging the export of commodities. In these circumstances, transactions between particularly big firms assume a form bordering on corruption, as Schilder delicately puts it. Krupp in Germany, Schneider in France, Armstrong in England, are instances of firms having close connections with powerful banks and governments whose share must not be forgotten when arranging a loan. France granted loans to Russia in 1905, and by the commercial treaty of September 16, 1905, she squeezed concessions out of her to run until 1917. She did the same thing when the Franco-Japanese commercial treaty was concluded on August 19, 1911. The tariff war between Austria and Serbia, which lasted with a 7 months interval, from 1906 to 1911, was partly caused by a competition between Austria and France for supplying Serbia with war material. In January 1912, Paul Deschanel stated in the Chamber of Deputies that from 1908 to 1911, French firms had supplied war material to Serbia to the value of 45 million francs. A report from the Austro-Hungarian Council at Sao Paulo, Brazil states, "The construction of the Brazilian railways is being carried out chiefly by French, Belgian, British, and German capital. In the financial operations connected with the construction of these railways, the countries involved also stipulate for orders for the necessary railway material." Thus, finance capital, almost literally one might say, spreads its net over all countries of the world. Banks founded in the colonies or their branches play an important part in these operations. German imperialists look with envy on the old colonizing nations, which in this respect are well established. In 1904, Great Britain had 50 colonial banks with 2,279 branches. In 1910, there were 72 banks with 5,449 branches. France had 20 with 136 branches, Holland 16 with 68 branches, and Germany a mere 13 with 70 branches. The American capitalists, in their turn, are jealous of the English and German. In South America, they complained in 1915, five German banks had 40 branches and five English banks had 70. During the last 25 years, Great Britain and Germany have invested in the Argentine, Brazil, and Uruguay about $4 billion, which places under their control 46% of the total trade of these three countries. The capital exporting countries have divided the world among themselves in the figurative sense of the term. But finance capital has also led to the actual division of the world. Chapter 5. The division of the world among capitalist combines. Monopolist capitalist combines, cartels, syndicates, trusts, divide among themselves, first of all, the whole internal market of a country, and impose their control, more or less completely, upon the industry of that country. But under capitalism, the home market is inevitably bound up with the foreign market. Capitalism long ago created a world market. As the export of capital increased, and as the foreign and colonial relations, the spheres of influence of the big monopolist combines, expanded, things tended naturally towards international agreements among these combines and toward the formation of international cartels. This is a new stage of world concentration of capital and production, incomparably higher than the preceding stages. Let us see how this supermonopoly develops. The electrical industry is the most typical of the modern technical advancements of capitalism of the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries. This industry has developed most in the two most advanced nations of the new capitalist countries, the United States and Germany. In Germany, the crisis of 1900 gave a particularly strong impetus to its concentration. During the crisis, the banks, which by this time had become fairly well merged with industry, greatly accelerated and deepened the collapse of relatively small firms and their absorption by the large ones. "The banks," writes Geitels, "in refusing a helping hand to the very companies which need it, bring on, after a frenzied boom, the hopeless failure of the companies which are not permanently closely attached to them." As a result, after 1900, concentration in Germany proceeded by leaps and bounds. Up to 1900, there had been seven or eight groups in the electrical industry. Each was formed of many companies, altogether there were 28, and each was supported by from 2 to 11 banks. Between 1908 and 1912, all the groups were united into two, or possibly one. The diagram below shows the process. Groups in the German electrical industry. Prior to 1900, Felten and Guillaume, Lahmeyer, Union AG, Siemens and Halske, Schuckert and Company, Bergmann, Kummer. By 1912, Felten and Guillaume and Lahmeyer merged to Felten and Lahmeyer. Union AEG became AEG, Siemens and Halske and Schuckert and Company became Siemens and Halske Schuckert. Bergmann remained the same and Kummer failed in 1900. By 1912, Felten and Lahmeyer and AEG merged into AEG, General Electric Company, Siemens & Halske Schuckert and Bergmann merged into Siemens & Halske Schuckert. And the two remaining groups have been in close cooperation.